32 to 40 and mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs 47 to 51. Looking ahead to Thursday, cloudy with highs in the upper 40s.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Storm surging. A government minister in Jamaica tells us what they're doing to keep people safe as Hurricane Melissa hits the island. And he tells us about the toll the historic storm is already taking.
And clinching the deal. President Donald Trump appears to hit it off with Japan's new prime minister as the two countries solidify their trading relationship. We'll find out what their new friendship might mean for the United States' more complicated relationship with China.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here in a few moments on People Powered KAXC. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Let's take a listen to our album of the week. It's called Getting Killed by the band Geese. Geese has been making art rock since 2016. Some call them a little too jammy for indie rock, or maybe a little too eccentric for the jam scene. Our Area Voices producer Andrew DeZingle compares them to Talking Heads for a Gen Z world. The song we're going to hear from Geese is called Islands of Men. You can let us know what you think of it. Text us 218-326-1234.
From what is real and what is fake.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Weathering the storm, the man helping lead Jamaica's response to Hurricane Melissa describes the scale of the catastrophe already unfolding and what they're going to need to make it through the aftermath.
Trading places. Donald Trump cozies up to Japan's new prime minister and signs a deal that will see billions in Japanese investment in the U.S. An expert tells us that's good for those two countries and a clear message to a third country, China.
Standing up to the notwithstanding, Alberta uses its federal charter override to force teachers back to work. One teacher tells us the labor action wasn't about higher pay, but about ensuring her students have the best learning environment possible.
They had pivotal decisions made for them. Now the authors of a new report hope their work will help Canadian survivors of forced sterilization make their own informed decisions about their reproductive health and fertility moving forward.
Autobiography. All seemed lost when Ray's car and her songbooks inside were stolen last year, but the British singer-songwriter is back with a new album and proof, perhaps, that she's still got the drive.
And starting pitchers. A bar and grill in Iqaluit is a local hub for baseball fans, and after Blue Jays commentators mentioned it on the air, praising its hospitality, its manager feels like she hit a grand slam. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that's always raising the bar. This is not the time to be brave. That is the urgent warning from Jamaica's Minister of Community Development, Desmond McKenzie, as the island braces for the worst of Hurricane Melissa. The Category 5 storm came ashore today near New Hope, slamming Jamaica's southwestern coast with winds topping 297 kilometers an hour. We reached Minister Desmond McKenzie earlier today in Kingston, Jamaica.
Desmond McKenzie, what can you tell our listeners about what Hurricane Melissa is doing right now?
Well, we are under full pressure from Melissa. Mm-hmm. Melissa is here. The western part of the island is being treated in a very, very bad way by Melissa. The entire parish of St. Elizabeth is underwater. Westmoreland, Clarendon, Manchester, as I speak. The system is really, really, on top of us.
Is it as you expected?
We expected, based on our weather forecast, this level of rainfall and wind. We're seeing roofs being blown off from hospitals, post offices, roads inundated, trees falling, electricity. At least 61% of the country is without electricity. There is intense damage to infrastructure, especially to our agriculture sector. We are expecting to have the hurricane, the system with us for another probably 2 to 3 hours before it leaves the shores of Jamaica. Leaves the shores of Jamaica, we will have the rains and the flooding and the wind. So we are not out of the woods for the next probably 5 days. We are going to be experiencing severe conditions.
Do you feel that people took the warning seriously, that they understood that Melissa was in fact different than anything else that's hit before?
Jamaicans are cognizant of our predicament when it comes on to disaster, because we are in the top 5 disaster mm-hmm. countries in the world. We sit in our earthquake zone fault line. We had the experience of Gilbert 37 years mm-hmm. ago. We have had experiences of hurricanes, but we are living in a time now where social media has also contributed to a lot of what we are seeing, because there have been a lot of misinformation that is being spread. And, there are a lot of people who believe in social media. But overall, the government did a good job, because we have been saying to the country almost on a daily basis. We have our press briefing every day, sometimes twice a day. you know, to advise the public, and we were out there, you know, the elected representatives, the mayors and thing, we saturated the country with information, so the country didn't lack information. But you have a set of people who still continue to believe that, you know, the hurricane will never come. But it is there, and, you know, a lot of people now, you know, realize what we were saying. And I hope and pray that the extent of the damages is only on infrastructure and not on the loss of life.
Yeah, many people feel the same way. I wonder if you know at this stage how long people may still be without power.
Well, that is going to be tricky. Mm-hmm. At the command center where I'm right now, we know that there are about 61% of the country that are without electricity. We know that the entire St. Elizabeth and sections of Manchester and Westmoreland mm-hmm. would be out power. So it is going to be difficult. One thing I know, based on the advance of burial, we had pre-positioned persons from overseas to come into the country. So we have about 100 line persons from the Caribbean, from the U.S. that has been in Jamaica now for about a week and a half mm-hmm. that has come in to help us when it becomes necessary for the restoration of our electricity. So that in itself will take some while. It is early to say what is the real assessment mm-hmm. as we speak, as it covers the entire island. But as I said, the western part of the country is going to be severely challenged. And it is not just our lighting, but it's also our water system.
Yeah.
St. Elizabeth is the breadbasket of the island, where our agricultural product, 80% of what we produce as ground provisions, agriculture for local consumption and for export, comes out of that section of the country that is being battered as I speak by Melissa.
As you know, Minister, there are people across Canada and the United States with deep, deep connections, love and ties to Jamaica and its people, their families, their loved ones and friends, and they're trying to organize, you know, aid as best they can. What would you want to say to them? What is, if anything, you know, needed at this point? How can they help?
Well, there is a needs list. Our consulate, both in the United States and in Canada, there are information that is available online mm-hmm. for donations, because we want this to be done in a structured way. The information on the site, the name of it is supportjamaica.gov.jm.
Minister, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for taking the time, and please take care.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Desmond McKenzie is the Minister of Community Development and the Deputy Chairman of Jamaica's Disaster Risk Management Council. We reached him earlier today in Kingston. Teachers in Alberta are going back to the classroom, but they are not going willingly. Early this morning, the provincial government forced 51,000 teachers back to work, ending the weeks-long strike. But it's how they did it that has unions up in arms. Danielle Smith's government opted to use the Charter's notwithstanding clause, which allows them to override constitutionally protected rights for a 5-year period. The government says it had to use the clause to make sure the teachers stay back at work by shielding the province from court challenges. Elise Auger is a teacher. We reached her in Calgary.
Elise, do you expect to be back in class tomorrow?
Yes, I expect to be there bright and early tomorrow morning.
And how are you feeling about that?
I have mixed feelings about it because I've been missing my students. I love my students. They are the best part of my day. So I'm excited to see them. And at the same time, I'm extremely disheartened and upset about the new legislation that's been passed here in Alberta.
Back to work bills don't usually require the use of the notwithstanding clause. So from where you sit, what do you make of the government's decision?
From my perspective, it really feels like it's a power play. It's a control play. They knew that they were going to be violating worker rights with the introduction of this bill. And in order to prevent court cases that would relate to Section 33 of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, they used the notwithstanding clause to stop that from happening.
What would you say to people who are happy that, you know, students can go back to school and those who agree with the government that the strike needed to end and that it couldn't keep going?
I'm sad when I hear that because it reiterates that people aren't aware of the classroom conditions these kids are in. The overcrowded classrooms and the complexities are at an all-time high in Alberta, and people aren't aware of it, or else they don't value that for their kids. And I would like to believe that everybody wants the best possible learning environment for their child. And so sending us back to work in the same conditions is just, it's not going to be beneficial for the children.
What was on the line for you in this strike? In an ideal world, how would you have liked to come back? What would you have liked to see your fellow teachers sign on to?
I really wanted our voices to be heard. I wanted to feel like my expertise and my experience mattered. And I wanted bargaining. I wanted negotiation. I wanted, you know, the ATA brought a proposal to the table, and rather than negotiate it and come up with a counter proposal, TIBA and the government just shot it down and stonewalled the ATA, and then went on to describe how it was the ATA that wasn't giving proposals in the first place.
It was a nasty fight, as you're clearly outlining there, and there have been other examples. Were there any real attempts for compromise?
From my perspective, no. When the proposal was submitted and the government had requested to go back to mediation, but only under the condition that class sizes and classroom complexities would not be discussed in mediation. And those were the two things that teachers really, really wanted addressed for the success of Alberta students.
The bill imposes this agreement on teachers, and it does come with salary increases, 3% a year. There is a commitment, as I understand it, to hire thousands of new teachers and educational assistants as well. How do those sit with you?
I am happy that there will be potentially some new teachers. What's difficult about a promise that's not written into collective bargaining is that there's no way of knowing who's getting those teachers, what the criteria is for getting a new teacher, because when you break it down, 3,000 teachers is 1,000 teachers per year is not even one teacher per school in Alberta. So how do we know who gets those teachers? Where are those teachers coming from? And same with the EAs at 1,500 EAs. When you have such complex needs in the classroom, that's not even one EA per school, let alone in a classroom. We wanted something measurable and actionable so that we could all be held accountable.
We often hear from provincial leaders, and we have in Alberta as well, you know, that this is about students and getting back to the classroom and getting students what they need. From what you're saying, what they've done, what the province has done, from what you're saying, doesn't feel to you like that it's about that?
I think they want to get kids back in the classroom. I think that is their priority. I don't think that they're giving students what they need because they're sending them back to the same conditions that they were in before, which means they haven't acknowledged the problems that are in the classroom right now.
In 2022 in Ontario, as you may know, there was public outcry and the government had to back down from using the notwithstanding clause in its fight with education workers. Are you getting any sense at this stage that that kind of public response might shift things there?
To be fully honest, the public response seems to be, I still want to believe that most people are still strong supporters of teachers and of the education. So I would hope that something like that could happen out here. But there has been people, at least online, that are very loud in defense of the decision that was made by the government as well. So I'm not sure if that will happen out here or not.
I know teachers have been feeling a lot of pressure during this situation over the last several weeks, and attacked even. What did that look like and sound like for you?
It's been hard. You know, I'm going to try and not get emotional here, but I love my job. I love my kids. They are the priority. My students are, I try my best every single day. And that's the truth about my job and my character. And so when I see online that teachers are greedy and we're being vilified as not caring at all about students and being selfish and only caring for ourselves, and this being a money issue and all this false information, it really takes a toll on my morale.
What will you tell your students when you go back?
You know, I'm waiting for some instruction on that. Mm-hmm. I want to be clear that, you know, I tried my best to get better conditions for them, and that we're going to power through and we're going to continue doing our very best learning, and I'm still committed fully to their education.
Well, Elise, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Elise Auger is a teacher. We reached her in Calgary. We requested an interview with Alberta Premier Danielle Smith, but she was not available. In a country with one Major League Baseball team, Canadians are uniting over the Toronto Blue Jays. Fans are gathering across the country to cheer on the Jays as they battle the Los Angeles Dodgers in the World Series, and they are dedicated, even if not everyone made it through last night's nearly 7-hour, 18-inning Game 3. Let's not talk about that. Even in more remote cities, baseball fans have had company. During last night's game, one particular establishment got a special shout-out from commentators Buck Martinez and Dan Shulman.
I know someplace else that's watching this game right now, the Stonehouse Bar and Grill in Nunavut. There's about 120 to 200 people at the Stonehouse Bar and Grill. Valerie Hill is the proprietor of that great bar up there in Nunavut, and they are big Blue Jay fans, and we want to thank you for watching.
Amazing. Just an amazing fan base sprawled over so many thousands of kilometers across the country. And everybody tuned in to this game tonight.
We reached the manager of that bar, Valerie Hill, in Iqaluit.
Valerie, as you well know, Buck didn't quite get the name right. It is the Storehouse, of course. Not the Stonehouse, the Storehouse. But to hear that, to hear your name, did you clock it right away?
Well, funny thing is, like, I had prime seating last night. I was in a leather chair in front of our fireplace, staring at a 65-inch TV. And just at that moment, one of my servers had come to me and said, you know, I accidentally punched something wrong. Can we fix it? And I was like, oh, yeah, comp it. 100% off. All of a sudden, all these people were cheering. And I looked at the TV. I said, nothing's really happening. What's going on? And then probably a dozen people came over wanting to high-five me. I don't know what's happening. And they said, did you hear that? No, I didn't. My phone started da-doop. The text, it was unreal. You would have thought it was my birthday.
So how long before you actually figured out or actually heard the clip we just listened to?
Well, you know, I made a new friend with an MLB reporter who did a story on us a few days ago. So I instantly messaged him on Instagram and I said, Matt, I can't believe Buck just gave me a shout out, but I missed it. And he just said, no way, really? He said your name? And, you know, I continued texting him and I said, yeah, but I missed it. And he said, I'm in the broadcast booth right now. I will send you a clip of it. And then once I heard it, oh my goodness, I had already had tingles and all my arm hair standing up just from watching the game and being in the bar. But this was monumental for me, being a little kid and a baseball fan and just thinking of my dad and my grandma who passed away a few years ago, how proud they would be. it might not seem like much to other people, but this was just like full circle. I'm so proud of my bar and my staff and this community and how they all come together to support one team.
I mean, it's this emotion is sweeping, you know, really right across the country. But your love goes so deep for baseball and the Jays in particular. Is it true that you got to step out onto the field?
Oh, yes. You know, from the time I can remember, my dad, I'm the youngest girl of seven kids. So from the time I can remember, my dad, I feel like he just picked a sport and said, you're going to be that. So I played T-ball, rookie ball. My dad and my mom, they coached all my little league teams. So when I was a kid, I won an all-Ontario competition where the grand prize was to go to the Sky Dome and throw the first pitch of a game, and this was after we won the World Series.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't remember actually throwing the ball, but I do remember looking at my dad, shaking Joe Carter's hand, meeting Roberto Alomar, everyone patting me on the back, and I was just excited to be hanging out with my dad at the Sky Dome. Oh. It was the first time I had ever been there. It's a cloudy memory, but the feeling still hits me like it happened yesterday. It's just incredible to me to be part of this. It's absolutely wild.
So,
and to shine a spotlight on our community through baseball is insane.
Was there a huge fan base for the Jays in particular, or are they, like some of us, perhaps the person you're speaking to right now, jumping on the bandwagon at the most appropriate time?
I think about 50% of our customers have been here since the start. But as we were getting to the playoffs and are we going to make the World Series, the crowds became more intense. So the staff that wasn't baseball fans before, they certainly are now.
How did you and they feel? I stayed up to the bitter end. Last night, history making, obviously. Painful in many ways. But when did you sleep?
So I barely slept, but Nunavut liquor laws are actually very strict. So at 11:30, we did last call, and because we're in Nunavut and everyone wears a jacket or a parka, we have a coat check. So at 11:30 came, I was like to our bouncers, start handing out the jackets, don't let anyone leave, we're watching this. So we stopped serving alcohol at 11:30, and we handed out all the jackets. We probably had about 50 people just glued to the big screen. And all of us were just the same emotion, the exact same time. Oh, no, another inning. Oh, no, another inning. So it was so much fun to be a part of. But as soon as 12 o'clock hit, you know, the laws come into effect. Sure. And we're like, we're so sorry. We have to kick you out. So me and a couple staff, we took our time cleaning. Mm. And we still had it on the big screen. But eventually, we all get tired and we had to go home. Oh, so I put it on my phone. I was watching Sportsnet. It was a little bit of a heartbreaker, but also kind of a relief because we were in have 6 hours, I think it was.
Oh, many hours. 18 innings and unforgettable.
Yeah.
And you have a special at the restaurant, right? At the bar tonight, the 18th inning. What is it?
Oh, yes. That's our new cocktail for tonight. It's called 18th Inning. It's tequila-based and a couple of extra ingredients. We make it blue by adding blue curacao.
Sure.
And we top it up with soda water and 7-Up. It's a delicious, really refreshing cocktail.
How do you think they are going to play either team after what they've been through?
Well, honestly, I feel like the Blue Jays are based on heart and determination, and their will to win is stronger than the Dodgers. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
So tonight is a fresh start. I'm sure they're tired, but I think we're going to go all the way. I think we might go 1-for-1 each game, but we're going to be there. I think I see us in the end holding up that trophy.
Valerie, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure.
Valerie Hill is the general manager of the Storehouse Bar and Grill in Iqaluit. That's where we reached her. After she won multiple awards for her debut album, fans were eagerly anticipating a follow-up from Ray, the British singer. Then they were breathlessly anticipating it. And then, to their surprise, they kept on anticipating it, but not getting it. What they did get, eventually, was an explanation. In 2024, Ray wrote on social media, quote, "It's my birthday and my car got stolen with all my songwriting books in the boot." That's British for trunk. "So no second album anytime soon. Love you, bye," unquote. Well, at last in September, she dropped a new single, "Where Is My Husband," which means a new album is coming very soon, which means she got her car back, right?
So it was a roller coaster journey, but what I didn't tell everyone is the police called me like maybe like 2 or 3 months ago and they were like, "We found your car." And I got it back. And not only did I get it back, like not one thing had been taken out of the car.
Oh my God.
All my songwriting books were there untouched.
So there's a whole other album in that.
So done. I was like, wow. So, yeah, so that's great. So everything ended well.
So
you know, never give up hope.
But whilst the car was gone out of your life and the songwriting books weren't there,
mourned that car. Like, that car is, like, my life. Like, it was my first car, and now I've got it back, so I'm driving her again, and it's really great. But
I'm happy that's back.
I love this car, and I just don't ever want to get a new one. Do you know what I mean? People are like, "You're still driving that thing," and I'm like, I just love my car. So
I'm
she's
happy.
Back.
Okay, good.
My songwriting books are saved. I didn't tell anyone that. Do you know what? I think strategically I'd bought myself some time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then my books came back and I was like, "Oh, sugar, let me not tell anyone."
So was this new single in that book? Did you remember this song?
No, but there was so much important stuff in there. And when I was back and flicking through it, I was like, thank God in the heavens above that this has been returned to me.
Ray on Capital Radio in the UK speaking to host Will Manning. Ray with "Where Is My Husband."
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, an assessment of the new deals the U.S. president just struck with Japan's new prime minister and what they might signal for other countries, including China.
And we'll hear from a young Saskatchewan man with autism whose love of hockey has landed him a gig as a commentator for the Prince Albert AAA team. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and As It Happens. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, you're our volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Weather for tonight, cloudy, chance of rain, lows 32 to 40, and tomorrow mostly cloudy, highs 47 to 51. Couple Halloween activities to let you know about. Revive Virginia has a trunk or treat on Friday evening, 4 to 6, on Chestnut Street, and the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce has a trick or treat event at the Emeralds Nursing Home, Halloween evening from 4 to 6. And the Marcel Family Center has a Halloween bash on Friday, 5 to 7:30. Families can enjoy food, games, candy, and more. There's more ahead from As It Happens on KAXE.
When new Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi met U.S. President Donald Trump in Tokyo for the first time today, she went with a bold yet informed approach, ingratiation. She gave him the late Shinzo Abe's putter. According to the White House, she told Mr. Trump she would nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize. The two leaders signed an agreement that would see the U.S. lower its import tax on Japanese goods to 15%, while Japan is vowing to invest $550 billion in the U.S. on top of a deal on rare earth and critical minerals. Nicholas Seicheni is a senior fellow with the Japan chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We reached him in Washington, D.C.
Nicholas, what is your assessment of how things went, this budding relationship between these two leaders?
I think it was remarkably successful. Japan is mired in a period of political instability, and Prime Minister Takaichi just took over a week ago. Mm-hmm. And Japan fundamentally depends on a close relationship with the United States. It's the centerpiece of Japanese foreign policy. And I think she was very gracious, flattered the president, and got things off to a great start. So it was really significant in the sense that Japan is now well positioned to not only have a strong relationship bilaterally with the U.S., but to really position itself to shape the way Trump thinks about Asia during his first trip to the region.
Was there worry before this meeting? I mean, obviously, Trump and former Prime Minister, the late Shinzo Abe, had a connection. You know, he was her mentor, the new Prime Minister's mentor, so there were links already. But was there any concern, given the unpredictability of the U.S. president and this administration?
Sure. Takaichi's connection to Abe certainly helped, and I think, you know, there are areas of alignment between Takaichi and Trump that I think benefited her personally. But for Japan and many other allies, there is concern about the unpredictable nature of U.S. foreign policy under President Trump. For example, her predecessor, Ishiba, came to Washington in February of this year, had a very successful summit. The president was very respectful. And shortly after that, the relationship was hijacked by very tense tariff negotiations. So you never know which direction the pendulum is going to swing. So for Takaichi, it was really important to establish rapport to generate some momentum.
A couple of important deals were struck, as you know. Let's start with the critical minerals deal, billions of dollars between the two countries in that. We know China is certainly a leader in that particular industry. So what message are both these countries, Japan and the U.S., trying to send with a deal like that one?
I mean, there is concern about China's strategy to limit access to rare earth as a tool of coercive diplomacy. And so Japan and the United States have a shared interest in securing supply chains for critical minerals in that context. President Trump also signed similar deals with Australia and Malaysia. And so it's a strong symbol of alignment between the U.S. and Japan. But I think Takaichi also gave Trump some leverage as he heads to Korea to meet with President Xi Jinping of China later this week. Mm-hmm. In other words, that the U.S. and its allies are going to stand up to Chinese coercive pressure. So Takaichi also handed Trump something to take with him into a bilateral meeting with an authoritarian leader. So that's also strategically significant.
Mm-hmm. Prime Minister Takaichi, you know, as we said, just only recently elected, leading a minority conservative government. A lot of headlines about her leadership just in these early days. Just tell our listeners a little bit about how her leadership is being received already.
Her public approval rating, although it's early days, is above 70% in recent polls. So the public has reacted very positively. I think part of the reason is that she's very decisive, very confident, and speaks clearly to the public about her vision, which her party, the Liberal Democratic Party, has struggled to do. But she will face a test, though. The LDP has really failed to come up with an economic growth strategy for Japan. And the Japanese people are struggling with inflation. They want answers on economic policy. And so she will be tested on the domestic front. But as this meeting with Trump showed, she's already demonstrated her capabilities on the diplomatic front. So she can balance those two. I think that's a recipe for some stability and some long-term leadership in Japan, which is really critically important.
What do you see? I know early days, obviously, but from what you know of her and her campaign, what is her vision? Where do you see Takeuchi taking her country during her time in office?
Well, her campaign platform was all about the strength of Japan. She weaved that theme into all of her policy prescriptions. And I think that was really important because of the political situation, the Japanese public was losing confidence about Japan's strength economically, but also its leadership role in the world. And so she flipped that around in a heartbeat, which is a very neat way to talk about her agenda going forward. She's very tough on defense. She wants to accelerate the current defense strategy. She wants to increase defense spending to 2% of GDP by next March. The original plan was to do that by 2027. So she's demonstrating to the Japanese people and also to the region that Japan is going to be a serious security actor. Mm. She'll have to deliver on the economy and immigration, which is another hot button issue right now. But I think she can carry this initial positive response from the public and implement an agenda that will set her up and set the LDP up for renewed leadership going forward.
As you look at the broader picture, the regional picture, these talks as Trump continues his trip, what are you going to be looking for to come out of them? You know, this meeting was a success in your view for Japan and its new prime minister. But big picture, what will you be looking for?
The interesting thing to me is that, you know, this trip to Asia was really about Trump attending multilateral gatherings, which are really important in Asian international relations. Mm-hmm. He started his trip in Malaysia, basically ignored the multilateral meetings with leaders. Then he goes to Japan and signals that the alliance with Japan is important to U.S. national interests. That sends a very strong signal to China. But then also have a one-on-one with Xi Jinping focused mainly on trade. So this trip by Trump really demonstrates his preference to talk one-on-one with leaders in the region. And I think his trip to Japan sets him up for a very positive trip to Korea, where he can come into a meeting with President Xi from a position of strength and try to reach an accommodation or an agreement with Xi on trade while demonstrating that the alliance network in Asia is still strong.
Nicholas, thank you for this. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Secheny is a senior fellow with the Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's in Washington, D.C. Canada's youth are part of the opioid crisis and need treatment. That's the title of an editorial published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal this week, in which doctors say that young people are hidden in the statistics of toxic drug deaths across this country. And they warn that if that crisis is not properly addressed now, quote, Canada's health systems will play a part in perpetuating the opioid crisis for decades to come, unquote. Dr. Shannon Charlebois is a co-author. She's also a medical editor at Canadian Medical Association Journal and a family physician.
So what we're seeing clinically are individuals getting involved with opioids at younger ages, which leads to an increased risk of not only consequences such as overdose, but also more severe addictions and more severe opioid use disorders in the long run. And that is of great concern. We're seeing it in younger children now. And if we're going to turn the situation around where 18 Canadians are dying every day of from the illicit opioid supply toxicities, we need to start at the root of the problem, and that's making sure our kids are growing up with the right healthcare support.
But how are young people arriving at using this drug at such an early age?
So that's a great question. So there are a number of different ways, but the classic story we hear is someone has a bottle of pills, they've swiped from a medicine cabinet somewhere, and they're handing them out at a party. That is how it starts. And we're not saying every kid is going to get addicted to opioids if they try them. That's not how addiction works. But for the people who are predisposed to an addiction for whatever reason, that's all it takes to start. What we need to be able to encourage is an open dialogue with kids. If someone comes to you, if a child comes to you, whether it's your own, whether it's a student, and they say, hey, I tried this at a party, that cannot be met with punishment. You have to thank them for their honesty and walk them through the potential consequences of that choice, because the first time they use could be the last time they use if they encounter the wrong substance.
You mentioned schools, and I'm wondering, what role do you think schools have to play in all of this?
So when we come to the role people tend to think of is prevention. So heading this off at the way before the past and just giving them education that drugs are bad. Well, that doesn't work. What we need in schools is, yes, of course, bring that message, but also recognize that many of these children are going to experiment with substances regardless, and they need harm prevention strategies. So I would completely have no problem saying every child in Ontario should be trained to use a naloxone kit, because it's basic first aid now, unfortunately.
Dr. Shannon Charlebois talking to Jill Dempsey on Metro Morning in Toronto today. The University of Ottawa says it's groundbreaking first-of-its-kind research on behalf of Indigenous survivors of forced and coerced sterilization in Canada. In a new report, the researchers describe all the assisted reproductive services, including IVF and surrogacy, that could be useful to survivors, as well as the costs and barriers associated with those fertility treatments. The authors write that it is their sincere hope that the report will, quote, offer guidance to Indigenous women seeking to make informed decisions about their reproductive health moving forward, unquote. The report was put together by the University of Ottawa Centre for Health Law, Policy and Ethics, and the Survivors Circle for Reproductive Justice. Harmony Redsky is the executive director of that nonprofit, which also provides financial support to survivors pursuing assisted reproductive technologies. We reached her in Winnipeg.
Harmony, I know you've heard from many, many survivors of forced and coerced sterilization. I can only imagine that stories like those are impossible to forget. It's a topic we've covered on this program before, but are there cases or one in particular that stays with you that you want to share?
I would say the majority of the stories that we have heard are not only heart-wrenching, but absolutely devastating that they could have occurred, and that these women have carried these stories, carried these horrible experiences with them their whole lives, and have, in most cases, not have had a lot of opportunity to do their healing work from the trauma that they've experienced, mainly within the healthcare system. One of the stories that stands out for me would be a story about an at-risk woman, a young woman who had struggled with mental health and addictions because of, you know, various other traumas that had impacted her, and just not having the autonomy, not having the authority or the control to be able to make the own decision about her sterilization. And so that is actually common, where the coercion that goes into this around forced and coerced sterilization is so underhanded in the way that it's been handled, particularly with vulnerable people. And that one story really stands out for me.
Part of the work your organization does is putting together a registry of people who have experienced forced or coerced sterilization. How many people are on that registry right now?
So currently there are a few hundred that are members of the registry, mm-hmm. and we have several hundred more who are in the process of completing their application or are in the review stage. We did do a call out between January and March of this year, and are looking to do another call out to reach the thousands of more survivors that are out there.
When we talk about when this happened to people, how recently have you heard of new cases of this?
Yes, some of the accounts that we've been looking at recently in our work just occurred within the last 5 years. Like, we're talking, you know, since the days of COVID, it has been not only isolated to one province, but across many provinces, with the most recent one that we are aware of occurring in 2024. A lot of the time in the last 5 years with these recent cases, these are young women. These are our mothers. These are professional women that this has happened to. And it is scary that it is still common and it is still happening today.
Survivors, their experiences informed this report. Research advisor Katie Baer is one of them. And Katie Baer recently gave birth to a child. What did she tell you about why she feels a report like this one was necessary?
When Katie came to us as a member of the Survivor Circle and shared with us the news about her pregnancy and the journey she was about to take with her pregnancy, it really did shine a light on this issue, on this area, around assisted reproductive technology, around tubal reversal and justice that survivors are seeking, and the necessary research that needs to happen to ensure that those supports and services are widely available, that there's cultural safety for Indigenous survivors who are looking at these options for themselves in not only their healing journeys, but the justice they are seeking here in Canada as they proceed through their lives. And Katie was so brave in sharing the story with us, but also being willing to participate in the research project and to help to guide and to lead with her firsthand experience about what she had gone through.
Some survivors may not want to pursue a future pregnancy given what they've endured through the healthcare system. What do you say to people who ask, how can the same system that did this to me, how can it possibly ensure safe and appropriate care now?
This is where we really have to look to and raise up the Indigenous physicians, nurses, midwives, and doulas that are working hard across the country to build a safer place for Indigenous people to access healthcare. And for us, that is absolutely something that we want to support and we need to support. It is building those networks and support systems for survivors to look at these options and to feel supported. It really is an important step for all healthcare providers in Canada, and this report helps to shine a light on what services are available, but also what they can be doing to improve the quality of care that they provide.
Harmony, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Harmony Redsky is the executive director of the Survivors Circle for Reproductive Justice. She's in Winnipeg. He is the new voice of the Prince Albert Mentos hockey team. Tanner Svensson has been hired as the color commentator for the Saskatchewan AAA team, and it's kind of an unexpected development for the 23-year-old. He has autism and was nonverbal for much of his childhood, but Mr. Svensson has found his voice behind the mic. Here he is talking to CBC Saskatchewan.
It's good to see the players that I see play, and they just work hard out there. It's just a great thing to see how hard these hockey players work. It's the second hardest sport in the world, or the hardest sport in the world, I would say, because you have so much speed, so much strength, so much mentality, physical things to even do with the ice hockey. I never played ice hockey personally myself. When I was younger, my dad wanted me to try to play, but I was just like, wasn't interested back then. And so I kind of regretted not playing ice hockey, but what I'm doing right now is just as equally as okay. Honestly, I'm hoping I can take this color commentary or do play-by-play with the Prince Albert Raiders, maybe do WHL. Hopefully I can get that chance one day, and I think I'm really going to go strive for broadcasting and do really well here since it's only my first year, so I might take a couple years, do a couple of color commentary, and then maybe take it up to the next level, do play-by-play. I just have this voice that I just want to just say, like, he shoots, he scores, and pass it across, and then back in, and he scores. Just want to say it like that. I just want to be one of those play-by-play who has a lot of passion and enthusiasm just to give the little pride and joy that I want to do for myself and to my family and community. I just want to give a really good call to a really awesome goal, like a Michigan or a really nice top corner backhand. I'd just be like, he's coming to the ice right now. He's on a breakaway. Dangles the goalie, and he scores right in there. And now he gets it done 1-0. And then here comes the defenseman. Slapper, and he scores. What a clapper from the defense. And it's 2-0, home team. Something like that.
That's the new color commentator for the Prince Albert Mentos, Tanner Svensson, talking to CBC Saskatchewan's Lisa Rizm.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.